This year is dedicated Le'ila Nishmas in memory of Rachel Leah Bas Chaim Tzvi. When it comes to Rosh Hashanah, certainly the most readily identifiable symbol of Rosh Hashanah is the shofar. We all know that the sounding of the shofar represents certainly one of the highlights, if not the highlight, of the Rosh Hashanah davening, of the service in shul on Rosh Hashanah. And there are many, many different laws, many of them technical, which relate to the mitzvah of tekiyah shofar. We certainly make a big production about tekiyah shofar, and correctly so. Even people who are unable to make it to shul on Rosh Hashanah due to illness or whatever other situation may come up, often have somebody come, the rabbi or somebody else come to sound the shofar. It's a mitzvah that we come upon once a year, the 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, and nobody wants to miss it. It's a dramatic mitzvah, it's a significant mitzvah, and what we'd like to look into in this year is try and get some insight, to look into the mitzvah of tekiyah shofar and gain some insight into what this is all about. On one level, a tekiyah shofar, the sounding of the shofar, is a mitzvah like other mitzvahs. The Torah indicates that we're required to hear the sounding of the shofar, and the Talmud explains that there are a certain minimum number of sounds, and God willing, we'll get back to some details relating to the sounds shortly. And it's a mitzvah like any other mitzvah. Why do we blow shofar? The Rambam tells us clearly, because it is what we call a gzeres hakosav. It's a mitzvah, it's a commandment, it's a decree that is found in the Torah, it's a divine decree, and we have to sound the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, much as we have to eat matzah on Pesach, we have to wave the lulav on Sukkot, and so on. However, the Rambam tells us that even though, indeed, the mitzvah of tekiyah shofar is simply a mitzvah that we perform because the Torah tells us to do so, nonetheless, there is a hint, there is a message that seems to be a little bit deeper than simply the discharging of the technical obligation that's inherent in this mitzvah. Namely, that the shofar serves, if you will, as a wake-up call to those who have been in a state of what we might call spiritual slumber during the course of the year. You know, if we think about it, we often approach any new activity, whether it's a new job or it's a new school year, it's a new opportunity, it's a new relationship. We approach it with tremendous excitement, anticipation, optimism. But oftentimes, as the year, the relationship, the situation, the job progresses, that initial excitement and that initial passion and that initial optimism sometimes or very often wanes. And when we come to the very end of the particular period of time in question, we look back perhaps with a certain amount of frustration and disappointment on what has taken place. And so when it comes to our religious commitment, when it comes to our involvement in Torah study and the performance of mitzvahs and acts of kindness, we often approach Rosh Hashanah, the beginning of the new year, with a certain sense of this year is going to be different. This year I'm going to get it done. I make all kinds of commitments and resolutions, if you will. It's a concept that was borrowed in secular sources as well. And we're prepared for making this into a wonderful year. And somehow, as the year goes on, very often we don't meet our expectations, we don't live up to the potential which we have set for ourselves, and so there's a certain sense of disappointment. And in a certain sense, we've fallen asleep at the wheel. And therefore, we come to the holiday of Rosh Hashanah, and the sounding of the shofar wakes us up. That's the Rambam's imagery. With my own addition a little bit. But that's the idea. The shofar is a wake-up call. It's like an alarm clock. And it tells us there's somewhere to go. You know, if you go to a hotel and you leave a wake-up call, it's because you have an appointment. You have someplace to go. There's a mission. There's something that's taking place that requires your attention. So you got to get up at whatever hour it is in order to get to your meeting or to your destination on time to be able to carry out that which you've planned. Well, the shofar serves as that kind of a wake-up call. And it tells us we've got to look to the future. There's somewhere to go. There's somewhere I got to be. And of course, part of the challenge of Rosh Hashanah is to figure out exactly where is it that I do have to go. What exactly are my plans? What should my plans be? Rosh Hashanah is certainly a time of reflection. Tekiyah shofar is a moment of reflection where a person should project forward and think, where is it that I'm heading? You know, the sages tell us that Rosh Hashanah is a time, of course, of renewal. One of the verses that's repeated numerous times throughout the service on Rosh Hashanah is the verse, Tiku b'chodesh shofar b'kesel yom chagenu, sound the shofar at the beginning of the month, the holiday which lands at the beginning of the month of Tishrei. That's a reference to Rosh Hashanah. This is a verse which is expounded to mean, chidshu ma'aseichem. You have to renew your activities, renew your deeds. Rosh Hashanah is a time to think about potential. Renew that which whatever it is that you're committed to. Look forward with a bright, optimistic approach. The mitzvah of tkiyah shofar comes as a wake-up call telling us, look forward. Where am I going? Where am I heading? Chidshu ma'aseichem. Shapru ma'aseichem. Chidshu ma'aseichem meaning renew and create a renewed vigor in terms of your deeds, and shapru ma'aseichem, make them right, make them good, make them proper. That's one of the themes of the mitzvah of tkiyah shofar. You know, our holidays on the Jewish calendar year, generally speaking, correspond to a particular event which transpired. So, of course, on the holiday of Pesach, we celebrate the Exodus from Egypt, right? At the Seder, we retell the story, everything that happened on that particular night, and that day, so many years ago when the Jews left Egypt. Pesach is Zecher Letzias Mitzrayim. It's a time that we celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim. When it comes to the holiday of Shavuos, for example, we recall the fact that we were given the Torah on this day, Zman Matan Torah Seinu. And Sukkot, we commemorate the period of time that we were in the desert, protected by God's, whether divine clouds of glory or actual physical huts and so on, by living in the Sukkah. What exactly is it that we're celebrating on Rosh Hashanah in terms of our history as a people? It is the beginning of the year, but does it correspond to anything? And the answer is it does. It corresponds to the creation of man. Rosh Hashanah is the day on which the world was created, but not the world was created day one of creation, but day six of creation, the day that man was created. And we discussed in the past shiur that it was on this day that Rosh Hashanah is observed, because it's only once man was created that there was an opportunity for God, so to speak, to be recognized as a king and as the master of the universe. But I believe we can suggest now that it goes beyond that point. What is it about the creation of man that's so significant? I mean, man is obviously unique among all the creation in terms of his intelligence and his capacity to function and to communicate, and so many different things that separate man from the animal kingdom. If we had to summarize that which man has in one word, I think a good word would be the word potential. Man has unbelievable potential. Now, the Pasuk, the Torah, when speaking about creation of man, presents a phrase which is very, very difficult to understand, a surprising phrase, and it's a phrase which has caused much controversy. Because when God says he's going to create man, in the Pasuk in Parshas Bereishis, he says, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man, in the plural form. In Hebrew, the distinction between the plural and the singular. So God says, let us make man, which gives rise to the question, who is he talking to? We believe there's only one God, there's no multiplicity of deities, right? So who is God talking to? That's a problem. Indeed, there are those who believe that God has more than one manifestation, or there's more than one God, something which we categorically reject. But those who believe in that will often prove it from this verse. The Torah itself, you Jews, your Torah, it says, the Bible says, Na'aseh Adam, let us make man. Clearly, there was someone else or some other manifestation that God was speaking with at that time. Otherwise, the term let us makes no sense. It should say, let me make man, or I shall make man, not we shall make man. E'aseh Adam in the technical Hebrew is a opposed to Na'aseh Adam. So many of the commentaries have their different responses to this question. But one brand, Rashi deals with it, suggesting that God was talking to the heavenly angels and other heavenly beings, which are not God, but they are, so to speak, God's assistants, his hosts, and so on up in the heavens. Others suggest that God was talking to the earth. Man was created both from the spiritual and from the physical. So it's let us, God provided the spiritual side of man. The earth, the dust of the earth, provided the material component of man. But perhaps if we suggested that there's something else. You know God was talking to when he said, Na'aseh Adam, let us, or we shall make man? He was talking to man himself. What does it mean? It means that God endows every human being with a certain capacity, a certain potential. That's God-given. But what a person does with that potential, that's up to him. So certain people have potential to have tremendous academic success. But how many times, I speak as a teacher now, do we have students who don't live up to their potential? They have tremendous natural ability, tremendous mental capacity, tremendous academic talent, and yet, unfortunately, they waste it. And we can think of this type of example, I think, in many, many different spheres, many, many different areas. Those who follow sports, how many times do you hear about a particular ball player who comes to a team, and this guy's got it all. He's got all the tools, the speed, and the power, and whatever else you're looking for in the athlete. But he never materializes into a star player. Somehow, he doesn't maximize his potential. And certain people are hired by a company because they seem to have tremendous ability and tremendous talent, and they're a disappointment. Na'aseh Adam, God talks to every person and says, we're going to make you together. I will give you, I will endow you with certain abilities, whatever that ability is. Everybody's got their own talents and their own abilities. But what you do with that potential, that's up to you. Rosh Hashanah is a time to reflect on potential, because now we're projecting forward. Whatever happened in the past year, maybe I fell asleep at the wheel, maybe I fell asleep, I wasn't able to accomplish, but now it's Rosh Hashanah. The shofar wakes us up, and like a wake-up call that tells us there's something I got to do today. Okay, the hotel phone rings, or the buzzer goes off, I got a meeting in 2 hours, I can't be late, because a lot depends on this. So shofar comes and tells in Rosh Hashanah, a lot depends on this too, we're going forward, you've got potential, you've got to realize your potential. So in that sense, perhaps Rosh Hashanah is a holiday which celebrates potential. It celebrates what man can accomplish. Na'aseh Adam. And therefore, I reflect back on the past year and think, well, maybe I fell short. Maybe I wasn't as successful as I could be. But now it's going to be different. I have a wake-up call now. I'm looking ahead. I'm looking into the future. That's the idea of potential. Chidshu ma'aseichem, renew things. You know, we speak of something which is new. So sometimes we think of youth and of the young. Youth is categorized often by tremendous passion, tremendous excitement, tremendous looking forward. Unfortunately, sometimes when people get older, so they have a different, perhaps a jaded view of the world and what can be accomplished. But from time to time, once a year at least, we need that wake-up call to tell us, no, we're young again. It's a new year. It's a beginning. It's a clean slate. There's something we can accomplish this year. Let's try and get that same passion that we had and renew that passion. All of this is perhaps one of the themes that is symbolized by this mitzvah of Tkiyas Shofar. And it's interesting, there are those who have a text, we make a bracha, we make a blessing before Tkiyas Shofar. The text of the bracha is Lishmoa Kol Shofar, to hear the sound of the shofar. That's the text that we have. And it makes sense, obviously. God has commanded us to hear the sound of the shofar. However, there are those authorities, quoted by the Rishonim, the commentaries in the tractate Rosh Hashanah, who have a slightly different text. One word, one letter difference. Instead of Lishmoa Kol Shofar, Lishmoa Bikol Shofar, which means to listen to, not just to hear, but to listen to. You can hear something without listening. We pause for a moment. You know, you can hear various sounds from outside. You can hear, whether it's an air conditioning unit going on, a bus passing by, children screaming in the street. You hear it without listening. That's hearing. But hearing is not the same as listening. Listening means to be attentive. Listening means to listen to the message, to hear what it is that's being sent to you. So there is one authority. We don't accept it, lahalacha, it's not our practice, but it says that the correct bracha is lishmoa bikol shofar. To hear, to listen to adhere maybe, to have an emotional response to the sound of the shofar. You know, when we eat matzah on Pesach, so there's no particular reaction that we have to the physical act of eating matzah. It's a significant act, okay? But it's what we call in Talmudic language a ma'aseh ha-mitzah. Ma'aseh ha-mitzah, action. We do it. We eat the matzah. We shake the lulav. With shofar, it's not enough just to hear the sound of the shofar. It's lishmoa bikol shofar. Even though we don't say that particular text, that's not our custom, but still the message is clear. We have to listen to it. There is what we might call a kiyum shebelev. There is an internal, an emotional response that has to come with the shofar as well. Now, many prayer books, many machzorim print that the famous Rabbein of Sadia Gaon, or the early rabbinic authorities, before the year 1000 of the Common Era, so Rabbeinu Sadia Gaon actually listed off 10 different things which are symbolized by the shofar. And it's worth, we're not going to go into them now, but it's worth getting hold of a machzor. Many machzorim have English or in whatever language they print in association with the Tkiyas Shofar, these 10 wonderful illusions of the shofar. But the fact is that there's an inner emotional fulfillment. And therefore, the idea is that although, as we started, the Rambam tells us that the Tkiyas Shofar is a mitzvah, like any other mitzvah, it's an act, it's a deed that we have to do, we have to hear the shofar, but there is something that is subjective. It's not just an external subjective, but an internal objective. I'm sorry, an external objective is rather an internal subjective mitzvah. Every person is alone with his own thoughts. When that shofar is sounding, we can all picture it, the shul is silent, okay, and people are just devoted to what's going on. Every person is, quote-unquote, lost, if you will, properly lost in his or her own thoughts. That's the idea of lishmoa bikol shofar, to listen to it, to pay attention to the sound of the shofar. Now, we have, actually, several different types of sounds that the shofar produces. Strictly speaking, there are two different types of sounds. There is what's called a tekiah, which means a flat, unbroken sound. That's what a tekiah means. And then that's based on a verse in the Torah that speaks about sounding a wind instrument that uses the expression uskatem. You shall sound, but it means a tekiah is a flat, unbroken sound. Then there is a sound called a trua. A trua means a broken sound. Okay, tkia, flat sound, unbroken. Trua, a broken sound. The Talmud records a debate as to exactly what do you mean by a broken sound. And the Talmud presents three possibilities. It can be a very short, sharp, broken sound, in musical terminology called staccato. So it's like a da-da-da-da-da type of sound, almost like a machine gun, rapid fire, right? That's a broken sound. Or it can be, that's what actually the Talmud and we popularly call a trua. Or the sound can be a broken sound, but each individual note, so to speak, is not rapid fire short, but a little bit longer. A sound and a pause, and a sound and a pause, and a sound and a pause, okay? Not that long, it's not as long as a tekiah, and there's significant technical discussion exactly how many seconds it has to be, and that's for an investigation perhaps at some other time. But this other type of trua is not a short, sharp, staccato type of broken sound, but rather a longer broken sound. Or, possibility three, it's a combination of the two. Some long broken sounds, some shorter broken sounds. Collectively, that's called shvarim teruah. So we actually, in performing the mitzvah of tekiah shofar, actually do everything. We have the tekiah. We have the short, sharp sound that we call trua. We have the longer, broken sounds called shvarim, and we have the combination of shvarim and trua. That's why there are so many different sounds that are produced by the shofar. But what's the idea of these two basic different sounds? And the basic distinction is there are some flat sounds and there are some sharp sounds. And here we come to, I think, what is another major theme relating to tekiah shofar, and that is the idea that the shofar at once represents that which is flat, ordinary, fine, comfortable, and that which is broken, which reflects a sense of, if you will, uncertainty, almost of panic. You know, some of us may recall in Israel a number of years ago, so when there was a threat of poison gas type of warfare coming from Iraq, or if a person may recall, may have studied the American history and will remember air raid sirens and so on. So when you want to alert the people to trouble, it's a wailing kind of broken sound. The siren goes up and down. It's a broken sound. And the all clear sign is one long flat sound. Somehow, psychologically, that's what it's about. When there's a sense of panic, when there's a sense of nervousness, when there's a sense of concern, so it's almost like a broken sound, it's a wailing sound, it's different notes, it's not just one flat sound. When things are okay, all clear, it's a flat sound. Well, in a certain sense, perhaps one can suggest that there's the same idea with tekiah shofar. Tekiah shofar, even as Rosh Hashanah itself, as we developed in the last year, even as Rosh Hashanah itself has themes that are almost paradoxical, tekiah shofar itself, the mitzvah tekiah shofar, contains paradoxical messages. On the one hand, tekiah shofar is a message, it's an assurance that all is well. We sound, so to speak, that all clear sign, right? That long, unbroken sound which represents that all is good, that things are smooth, that things are going well, that we're on a path, right? That there are no bumps in the road. On the other hand, we also sound the truer sound, the broken sound, the panic type of sound, the nervous kind of sound. Things are broken, things aren't clear, there are bumps in the road. We kind of merge these sounds throughout tekiah shofar. And that's really, in a certain sense, what tekiah shofar is. Because man, is that paradox. On the one hand, we have a hope and we have a mission that everything is going to be clear. On the other hand, we know that there are bumps in the road. And so tekiah shofar is our opportunity to call out to God in both scenarios. Now, the way it's structured, the good news is that every trua, the Gemara tells us, based on verses in the Torah, every trua, every broken sound, every sharp, nervous, kind of panic type of sound, has to be preceded and followed by the tekiah. There's the all clear at the beginning and the all clear at the end. So the ultimate message is a positive message. And indeed, the Ramban, in his commentary on the Chumash, tells us that tekiah shofar actually serves to create a bridge between the theme of Yom HaDin, as we spoke about in the last year, that Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment, and therefore inherent in judgment is a sense of nervousness, a sense of lack of clarity, of lack of being sure. Again, to use the example, if someone would be summoned, even if you know you're innocent, and even if you have all kinds of proofs, but most people, if they're summoned to appear before a judge, you go to a courtroom, there's a certain nervousness that's there. Just the atmosphere, just the theme, makes you nervous, because, hey, you never know what's going to happen, what could go wrong, maybe you won't be able to articulate yourself properly, maybe there's something something you didn't know about, you forgot about. So there's always a nervousness when you come before a judge. Well, how much more so should there be a sense of nervousness when you come before the supreme judge of judges, right? God himself, who is, as we discussed again in the last year, sitting on this day with the books of the living and the books of the dead open, making decisions as to what kind of year this will be. So of course, there's a sense of nervousness. And this din is represented by the trua. Your person feels, literally, if you will, shattered. That's really what the word trua means. One theme, one etymological root of the word trua is from a word that means that which is shattered, that which is broken. A person feels shattered. I'm broken. Here I am standing before God on the day of judgment. What in the world am I going to say? I look back, as we said before, I fell asleep at the wheel. Things started off maybe well, but the year dragged on and different things happened. Sometimes my fault, sometimes not my fault. But I sit on the day of judgment. There's no excuses. What in the world am I going to say? Who would not be frightened on such a day? Me? Is there a human being who's a thinking person that's not going to, who understands what's at stake here, who's not going to be... I have a sense of being shattered or broken, and that's really the trua of Rosh Hashanah. At the same time, the tekiah represents God's response, if you will, that all will be well. That there is a road, as we said before, you can look ahead and say, you know what, I've got potential. Maybe last year I didn't live up to my potential, but this year I'm going to live up to my potential. There's a tekiah, there's a flat sound which signifies that all is clear. It changes, so to speak, the mitzvah of shofar, the Ramban says, changes the harsh, frightening, awe-inspiring judgment into rachamim, into friendship. And indeed, as we mentioned last year, the word trua, while it does have the etymological connection to a word meaning shattered and broken, signifying panic, it's also, again, paradoxically, at the same time, connected to the word rea, friend. God is our friend, and he responds to us accordingly on Rosh Hashanah. So that, what is it that sort of transforms the potentially harsh, shattering type of judgment into friendship and into mercy? Tekiah Shofar. Tekiah Shofar has this tremendous power, and that's why it's not simply, as the Rambam tells us, Maimonides tells us, it's not just a mitzvah. It is. Fundamentally, it's a mitzvah from the Torah, but it also has this imagery to it, this symbolism. Rabbi Nasad Yigon mentions so many things that brings us closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And in fact, we find in history that the shofar represented God's divine presence. And we'll elaborate this another time on this point. But the shofar was present, the Torah tells us, at Mount Sinai. The revelation of God, when he gave us the law, when he gave us the Torah, was accompanied by the sound of the shofar. The temple in Jerusalem, which was the place where God revealed himself on a regular basis, shofar was sounded there on a regular basis, not just on Rosh Hashanah. And we're told in the future, the Messianic era, the great end of days, will be ushered in by the sounding of the shofar. So shofar represents God's being there, God's being accessible, God's being imminent, and being able to interact with man. And again, that carries with it a certain amount of tension, a certain amount of fear, because after all, I mean, how am I going to live up to it? On the other hand, this is my God, this is my friend. You know, just picture perhaps someone that you respect and have great honor and want to show great honor to. And he tells you he's coming over to your house. Maybe this is your Rebbe, this is your Rosh Hashiva, this is your teacher, this is your boss, someone you look up to, it's your mentor, it's someone you've admired for a long time. And suddenly out of nowhere, the person calls and says, listen, I'm available, I'm in the neighborhood, and I'd like to come for dinner. Oh, you're thrilled. What greater joy to be able to host this person in your home. Right? And so you want to have this person over. You admire him. You feel close to her, whatever the case may be. But aren't you also rather nervous? Boy, you want to be just so. You don't want the house to look dirty. You don't want anything to go wrong. And so there's a tremendous amount of nervousness and tension that accompanies the arrival of this person. This is someone you want to give a favorable impression to. So as excited and as happy you are that this person is coming, as happy as you are, you're also... Are you not a little bit nervous, a little bit tense, that maybe something will look different, something won't work out well, maybe the food will burn, or maybe something will spill? Who knows what concerns that we have? Well, that's the idea of God on Rosh Hashanah. The shofar symbolizes that God is near. He's revealed himself. In fact, the Gemara tells us that when the Navi, when the prophet Isaiah says, Dirshu Hashem bihi matzo, karau bioso karov, seek out God when he is nearby, right? Find God when He's nearby. So when He's nearby, isn't God always nearby? God never moves. So the Gemara has an explanation. Dear Shoshan, may Matzo Kuril be also Karov. It means these are the 10 days starting Rosh Hashanah, ending with Yom Kippur. In a certain sense, in some manner, God is nearer to us on this day, and it brings us these confluence of emotions. There's this excitement. Wow, I'm coronating God. Right, as we discussed in the last year, I'm proclaiming that God is the King. On the other hand, it's a day of judgment. What is it that gives us the ability to fuse these things in a positive fashion? That's the mitzvah of Tekiah Shofar. That's one of the ideas, that the Tekiah Shofar sort of allows us to shift from the sense of pachad, of terror, of nervousness, of concern on Rosh Hashanah, to a sense of friendship and relationship with God. There's more to it than that as well. You know, I would say that the other dominant theme of Rosh Hashanah, at least in people's eyes, although it's only a custom, is the idea of having something sweet. Many Rosh Hashanah cards that you see are advertising Rosh Hashanah, either they'll have a picture of a shofar, or they'll have a honey dish, or both. Right? We have a tradition that on the night of Rosh Hashanah, we eat the bread and honey, and dip apple and honey. Many people eat other types of foods, all of which are designed to sort of hint at the fact that it should be a good year. It's almost like a prayer that it should be a good year. And that's something, certainly, the little children, when they first learn about Rosh Hashanah, they have songs about dipping apple and honey, and it's an exciting thing. I know that in our house, so over the years, you know, we've gotten for gifts or whatever else, different honey dishes. So my wife sets the table. Everybody's got their own honey dish. And it's a big excitement. You know, you pass out the challah, pass out the apple. And it's just, you know, we're thrilled to have it. It's just, and it's, we always wonder, how come we don't dip bread and honey all year long? It's so tasty. Why do we only do it on Rosh Hashanah? But that's our practice, right? We do it on Rosh Hashanah. In addition to that, we, as many others, eat various other foods as well. Now, these foods are sometimes called the simonim. The simonim. We eat the simonim. Simonim literally means signals or signs. And by tradition, these foods are selected because the Hebrew word, or in some cases the Yiddish word, for these particular foods represent, if you have a place on a play on words, represent a prayer for some kind of success during the year. So it's either the taste of the food, or the food, the nature of the food itself, or something about the word that this food is referred to as, that somehow relates, again, often based on a play on words, to something which is positive for us, negative for enemies. And we say certain prayers at the table on Friday night. Now, some authorities object to this because we don't believe in superstitions, and we don't do things that are just sort of magical or superstitious in nature, and therefore, for example, the Rambam himself never quotes this practice. However, and it's different customs in different communities. Well, I think the bread and the honey, the apple and honey, is pretty widespread, but in many communities they do it. What's the idea of the simonim? So it's interesting that one place, and this is pointed out by the Bnei Yisoschar, one of the great Hasidic teachers, the Bnei Yisoschar notes that we find simonim in rabbinic literature in connection with a very famous story that's in the Torah. But before looking at the story in the Torah, it's interesting that the Haftorah, the prophetic section, which is read on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, includes a famous depiction of Rachel Imenu, our matriarch Rachel, weeping for her children who are off in exile. Some of the more powerful verses, in my opinion, in all of the Navi, never fail to bring tears to my own eyes. Those who have been in Israel to the tomb of Rachel, to Kever Rachel, will note that these verses that are read on Rosh Hashanah are inscribed in various places throughout that area. The verses state, and again, it's read on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, just before shofar blowing. Kol Hashem, kol beroma nishma. A voice was heard on high, wailing, nehi b'chi samruim, bitter crying. Rachel weeps for her children. She refuses to be consoled, for they are gone. Right? Picture in your own mind a mother weeping for her children who are gone and are missing. And so the verse continues that God says to her, restrain your voice from weeping and your eyes from tears. Right? Mini kolech mi bech ben ach min dima. Because eventually, v'shavu me'eretz oyev, they will return from the land of the enemy. And there's hope for the future. V'yesh tikva lach v'yisech num Hashem. V'shavu bonim l'gvulam. Your children will eventually return to their border. Very beautiful, very powerful verses. So the Medrash tells us, rabbis tell us, that when the Jews were exiled, so all of the great leaders of the past came forward, as it were, to plead with God to have mercy. Abraham came forward and said, you know, I was put through all these tests, and I came to realize your uniqueness and the concept of monotheism. I was the first one. No one in the world agreed with me. Everyone thought I was crazy, and I was put through tests. I was even willing to sacrifice my own son, which we also read about on the second day of Rosh Hashanah, which maybe we'll come back to. Please forgive the people. And God isn't moved. And he says, no, I can't do it. They deserve to be punished. And then Isaac comes forward and pleads, I was willing to give up my life. That Kedas Yitzhak, the binding of Yitzhak, again read on Rosh Hashanah, spare them in my merit. And God is unmoved. And Jacob and all the other great leaders. And suddenly, based on these verses, Rachel comes forward. And when Rachel cries, and when Rachel has these bitter tears, to her God responds. Why? I mean, not taking away anything from Rachel, but the other people, also worthy people. What is it about Rachel that was so significant? So the answer that some suggest is that when Rachel was to get married to Jacob, you'll remember the story from the Torah, Jacob had worked, Yaakov had worked for 7 years, expecting to marry his beloved Rachel, and the father, Lavan, pulled a fast one. And instead of arranging the wedding for Rachel, he at the last minute pulled a switch, right? They call it in advertising, bait and switch, right? So he pulled a switch, and instead, it was Leah that he married. Now, true that it was dark, and maybe they had certain similarities, but how is it that Jacob fell for it? After all, the rabbis tell us that Jacob had a suspicion that his father-in-law-to-be Laban was a wise guy. So he gave Rachel simonim. He gave Rachel certain signals, certain signs, that when he says certain words, she'll respond a certain way, he'll know that it's her. That way he wouldn't be duped. That way he wouldn't be able to have Laban pull the switch. But Rachel, out of her deep love for her sister and her desire not to embarrass her sister, gave over the simonim. That's what the rabbi tells. They gave over the simonim. And so therefore Rachel knew the signs also. And the merit of that deed is it was Rachel that God listens to, as described in the verse that I said before. What are the simonim? What a simon is something which is unspoken. When you're close with someone, when you have a relationship with somebody, sometimes you don't have to say anything. You can give a look. You can give a wink, you can motion with your finger, and the other person knows exactly what you're talking about. Maybe no one else in the room knows it. But you have a deep connection to somebody, you don't even need to speak. The words are enough. A simon is enough, just a sign. So perhaps, suggest the Bnei Yisrael, so when we eat the simonim, these different foods on Rosh Hashanah at the Seder, it's the declaration of our relationship with God. I don't have to ask you. You know what I mean. You know what I have in mind. You know what I'm thinking about, right? We have a deep sense of connection. So maybe someone else doesn't understand it. But you know what this simon means. Just like Leah was able to pull it off with Yaakov because she knew the signals, right? And they understood each other. That's the simon. That's the simon that Rachel gave to her sister. And that's, in a certain sense, the Bnei Yisrael says, the simon that we eat, quote-unquote, on Rosh Hashanah at night as well. All of this, as I understand it anyway, hints at a form of communication that doesn't require words. And whether or not you follow this practice of eating different foods on Rosh Hashanah night, what is the shofar if not communication without words? That's exactly what the shofar is. Human beings are able to speak, yes, that we are able to communicate. That's what separates us, I mentioned earlier, from the animal kingdom. But you know what? Our minds are finite. Our ability to communicate is finite. I'm sure many of us have been in circumstances, I know I have, where I'm with somebody and I can't find the right words. You ever have that experience of trying to, you don't know how to formulate it exactly? I know I sometimes do, and others also, when I know I have to meet with somebody, to speak to somebody, I go over my head first what I'm going to say. You want to prepare the words. And even then, sometimes the words fall short, right? Sometimes, somehow, you don't get to say it exactly the way you want to. Certainly, if you want to express love for somebody, it's often hard to find the right words. You know, I once heard what I thought was a very insightful remark, and I don't remember from whom I heard it, but I think it's a very, very valuable comment. God forbid, when somebody is sitting Shiva, when a person is in mourning following the death of an immediate relative, and we come to visit, so there's a formula that's said when you take leave of the person. Many times they have a little chart or a piece of paper or something hanging on the wall so the visitors can know what to say. Why did the rabbis have to pick a formula? I mean, everybody who's coming should express condolences in his or her own way. Isn't that why you come? This is a friend of yours, just experienced a serious loss. You want to express sympathy. So, you know, this is not, it's not a blessing. It's not a prayer. Why do you have to have a particular formula? And I think perhaps the answer is because you can't always think of what to say. So our sages gave us something to say. of course, you should elaborate. When you have a connection to somebody, you can elaborate. You don't have to say just those words. But those words are said because a lot of times we can't think of the right thing to say. What do you tell somebody who's never has undergone a terrible loss? Sometimes words fall short, and yet somehow you want to communicate that sense of empathy. You want the person to understand how much you care and how much you feel bad for them and how much you love them and so on. And words fall short. Well, now let's turn to our relationship with God. When it comes to our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we want to say words, but won't it automatically fall short? Can we ever really praise God the way we should praise Him? Can we ever really articulate our needs in the way that we would want to? It's very, very difficult. So the mitzvah tkiyas shofar is an unspoken prayer. It's a way of communicating to God just through sounds. But because God has a relationship with us, He knows what those sounds mean. We know what those sounds mean. That doesn't mean it replaces prayer. But actually it means, and God will in the next few elaborate on this point, it doesn't replace prayer, but it is a form of prayer. Shofar is actually a form of prayer. There's a famous story about one of the great Hasidic leaders of Levi Yitzchak of Berditchev. And the way the story goes, there was a mute shepherd boy who lived in a town. And what could he do? In those days, people who had certain disabilities just couldn't be educated the way we're able to educate today. And so a kid who was mute was not really able to go to school or able to learn too many trades. So they made him a shepherd. But he knew how to whistle. And he used to walk in the fields out in the outskirts of the town with the different flocks, and he'd spend his whole day whistling. He'd whistle these different happy tunes. And the way the story goes, he came to shul on Rosh Hashanah. And on Rosh Hashanah, he was taken by the emotion that was present in the synagogue and the chazan singing and people praying with such devotion. And he wanted to be a part of it, but he couldn't speak. So he did what he knew how to do. So he got up and he began to whistle right in the middle of davening. Now imagine in your shul if that would happen. Right? Can you imagine in the middle of Rosh Hashanah, somebody walks up to the bima or to the front of the shul by the aron and begins whistling? Well, that seems to be the same response that you and I would probably have, at least initially, to such a person, was the response that they had. But the rabbi said, stop. This person's whistling is more meaningful to God than many of our words, because it comes from his heart. This is what he's doing. He's calling out in the way that he can. We're saying words. Sometimes it becomes mechanical. Sometimes words just become, you know, we're turning another page, you know, and again, who hasn't had the experience on Rosh Hashanah? Maybe as a youngster, but as an older person too, of looking in the machzor, seeing how many pages are left, right? Figuring out what page we're up to and how many pages are left. And there's more words and more words, and sometimes the words lose their punch. But this child was calling out from the depths of his heart. That's what shofar is. Shofar is a form in the rabbinic lingo of tzaka, of a crying out, almost like a primordial cry. I'm reaching out. I'm screaming. And you know, sometimes you scream because of pain, but sometimes you scream because it's just the response. And you know that somebody's there listening. That's what tkiyas shofar is. So tkiyas shofar has this element to it that it's calling out to God without words. Yes, we do say many words, and I don't mean to denigrate or belittle the significance of the words. And again, God willing, the next year, Har Hashanah will explain much about many of the words in the Musaf service. So it's not that we don't do the words. We do that too. But we blow shofar almost to acknowledge the fact that indeed sometimes words fall short. It's a means of communicating to God without the words. We sound the sound, and we have our thoughts. God understands our thoughts. It's like the simonim, it's like the signals that people who are close to each other have sometimes, just relate to each other. No one else knows what they're thinking about or what they're doing, but they know what they're thinking. That's exactly what takes place. And that's, again, perhaps another idea of the theme of tkiyas shofar. This form of prayer that is a crying out, a form of tzaka. You know, the most basic desire to scream out. You know, when a baby's born, before he can talk, what does he or she do? When he screams. Well, the mother knows what it means. The mother knows that the baby's hungry, right? Or the baby needs to be moved around or whatever it is. It's just a scream. You don't need the communication. The mother loves the child. The parent cares for the child. So they know full well what the baby intends and what the baby needs. And that's the idea of the scream here as well. Now, we blow the shofar prior to the Musaf service, right after putting the Torah away. These shofar sounds, the initial 30 sounds, are known as the tekiyas demiyushav. The tekiyas demiyushav literally means the seated tekiyas. Just so happens that our practice, we stand anyways, okay? But the tekiyas demiyushav are the ones that are prior to Musaf, prior to the Shmona Esrei. And the tkiyas de miyushov serve as the, not only as the initial tkiyas, but as the tkiyas which kind of, if you will, set the stage for what's going to follow. And shofar that sounded, the tekiyas that are blown at this time, are blown because we want to sort of call attention to this mitzvah as separate from anything else. The second set of tekiyas, I'll explain in a moment, are blown during the Shmona Esrei, during the Musaf Amida. Now, in some synagogues, they blow it both in the silent rendition of the Musaf Shmona Esrei, as well as in the repetition. That's some people have that practice. Others blow only in the repetition of Shmona Esrei, the loud recitation of Shmona Esrei by the Chazan, and not in the private silent Shmona Esrei. Two different customs, and I'm not going to get into that right at the moment. Those tekiyas are known as, the second set are known as the tekiyas de Me'umad, the standing tekiyas, because at that point we're all standing saying the Shmona Esrei. As I said before, our practice is we stand for the first set as well, but the second one has that nickname, the tekiyas de Me'umad. Now, the tekiyas de Me'umad is specifically in association with prayer. What do I mean? Well, it can raise a very, very simple, but I think a basic question. When we say the Shmona Esrei, the prayer, the tefillas, anytime, on a regular morning, on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, on Shabbos, on Sukkot, on a regular Tuesday in March, on a regular Wednesday in November, we're praying, right? We're communicating with God through the spoken word. Do we ever perform any other mitzvah in the middle of the Shmona Esrei? On Pesach, in the middle of Shmona Esrei, do we stop and go eat matzah? Certainly not. On Sukkot, do we go outside to the Sukkot in the middle of the Shmona Esrei? Certainly not. Any other mitzvah that one would do in the middle of the Shmona Esrei, in the middle of the Amidah, in the middle of the prayer service, would be considered what we call a hefzik. It's an interruption. You're not allowed to do that. You can't stop. Even on Hanukkah, we don't light the candles in the middle of the prayer. There's a mitzvah to pray to God. There's a different mitzvah to light Hanukkah candles. There's a mitzvah to say the Shmona Esrei on Pesach. There's a different mitzvah to eat matzah. Right? So we never do those things right in the middle of the Shmona Esrei, right in the middle of the service. We're going to perform this mitzvah. You wouldn't be allowed to do it. It would be considered a hefzik. A hefzik means an interruption, which would disqualify the prayer. So the question becomes, so how do we blow shofar? Especially those who blow it even during the silent Shmona Esrei, but even those who blow it only during the repetition. Since when do we perform another mitzvah smack in the middle of the Shmona Esrei? In the middle of the davening? I mean, let's finish the davening and blow shofar afterwards. Or let's be done with shofar before the davening. Like we do. We do blow the first 30 sounds, the so-called tekiyas de miyushav. We do blow those before. It sets the tone and it establishes the centrality of shofar. So that should be it. Now we're done with that mitzvah. Now we go on and we daven. What's this business of blowing the shofar? We stop. You'll picture it again in the shul. The chazan, the person, the cantor, the person who's leading the davening, says the bracha and stops. And then the rabbi or whoever else is blowing the shofar comes to the front. They blow the shofar. There's a delay. What's the delay? You're not allowed to delay in the middle of the Shmona Esrei. Under any other circumstances, a delay in the middle of the davening would be most inappropriate. It would disqualify the davening. I know in many shuls, and it's very nice, you know, there's a pause, the children come in, a lot of times they bring the kids to the, you know, to the center of the shul, or there's a break, everybody stands up for a moment, there's a whole delay while we get ready for shofar blowing. Why is this not an interruption? No matter how important shofar is, matzah is also important, matzah on Pesach is important, we don't do it in the middle of the Shmona Esrei. And the answer, of course, is, as we've been saying, that tekiyas shofar is not an interruption in prayer, tekiyas shofar is a prayer. It's just another form of prayer. You see, matzah on Pesach has nothing to do with prayer. And therefore, we eat matzah at the Seder. We wouldn't be allowed to eat matzah in the middle of davening because it would be an interruption. We wouldn't light Hanukkah candles in the middle of davening because Hanukkah candles have nothing to do with the prayer. But shofar we can do in the middle of Shmona Esrei because it's not interrupting the prayer. It is another form of prayer. So that's one of the proofs that Rabbi Soloveitchik and others brought to this notion that shofar is more than just a sound, fulfilling a technical mitzvah, producing a sound with this instrument, but rather it's a form of prayer to God. It's an unspoken word. It's a communication with God without verbalization, without human words. Human words, as I said before, often fall short. You know, the Talmud tells a story that there was a certain rabbi who was praying, and he really wanted to praise God. So he described God with all kinds of adjectives, the mighty and the great and the powerful and the strong and the merciful and the wonderful, all these different adjectives. So his Rebbe, his teacher, heard him And, you know, the fellow thought when he finished, oh, the teacher will be so proud of me. You know, I said this so many praises. Our regular davening only has a few praises at the beginning based on a verse in the Torah. But this guy added on his own. He wanted to say more praise, very noble intentions. So what did the teacher say to him? The teacher said, that's all you could come up with. He said 25 things, that's all? So he said another 10, that's all? No matter how many, he'll say, you're not going to, have you finished praising God? And his message was, no, you never finished. Stick to the text that the rabbis put in, because they put it based on biblical verses. That's all we can say. We can't do any more than Moses did when he prayed to God. The idea is, again, a person uses human words, no matter what words we use, we're always going to fall short. We say that actually in the davening on every Shabbos and Yom Tov, including Rosh Hashanah. We say that Ilu Finu Mole Shira Kayom. This is in the end of Psukah de Zimmer before Baruch Hu in the prayer called Nishmas. If our mouths were as full of song as the waters, or the seas are full of waters, and no matter what, if we had all these talents, we still would fall short of trying to adequately praise and thank God. So therefore we come to Tekiyah Shofar and we pray to God and we praise God and we petition God and we cry out to God through Tekiyah Shofar, because, and therefore, this is not an interruption prayer, it is a prayer. And there are a number of interesting halachas. You know, the Gemara tells us a shofar is supposed to be bent, right? Some wind instruments are straight. And certain animals have horns that are straight. Look in encyclopedia, go to a zoo, you can see animals, some animals have twisted horns and some have straight horns. Our practice is to use a twisted or a curved, a bent horn. Every shofar, now some people have, this is what they call the Tamar, the Yemenite shofar, where there's a double twist and so on, but whatever it is, every shofar is twisted at least somewhat. Why? The Talmud tells us because it's supposed to symbolize a person who's bent over in prayer. People who pray, so they're bent over a little bit as a sign of humility, as a sign of submission. Now, what does the shofar have to do with a person bent over in prayer? And we don't require or recommend a bent piece of matzah because, hey, you know what? The matzah should be bent, or the lulav should be bent because it's a... Why suddenly by shofar we're concerned that it should be reminiscent of someone bent over in prayer? Again, the same idea. Because shofar is a form of prayer. Shofar is a request. It's a crying out. It's a petition, if you will, to God. And therefore... we parallel the very item, the very shofar itself, is modeled or is intended to be reminiscent, if you will, of a person bent over in prayer. Now, it's interesting that right after Tekiyah Shofar, the first set of sounds before the Shemoneh Esrei, we refer to a verse, we cite a verse in Psalms, which says, Ashrei ha'adam yod'ei serua. For praiseworthy the people who knows the shofar blast, right? Praiseworthy or fortunate are the people who understand, who know how to blow a shofar, literally. Now, the question is, I mean, I'm not saying it's not a skill to blow the shofar. To be a good Baal Tekiyah on Rosh Hashanah is a skill and people practice. But let's be honest, other people can figure out how to do it also. There are musicians, you know, who are not Jewish, who understand Rosh Hashanah, but can figure out how to blow a shofar and can probably do a very good job. So what is this idea? Praiseworthy are the people who know the shofar blast. So obviously it doesn't mean who know how to blow shofar technically, but rather the Ramban tells us it's in a sense of loving or uniting with God in friendship and affection. You see, the word yodea means knowledge, it means intimate knowledge. When the Torah describes the relationship between Adam and Eve, when they first got together, and ultimately she became pregnant and had a child, it says, Ha'adam yoda eschava ishto, man knew his wife. Intimate knowledge, the most intimate kind of knowledge of somebody. So that's what the Ramban says here. Okay, the Ramban says here, that's what the shofar is. Fortunate are the people who can use the shofar to create this bond with God, as we've been discussing, right? Fortunate are the people who understand the significance of what shofar is about. Now, I said before, after blowing the shofar at the earlier stage, prior to Shemoneh Esrei, we say the Musaf Shemoneh Esrei, and we blow the shofar again, both during these, again, some communities during the silent Shemoneh Esrei and during the repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei, and others only during the repetition of the Shemoneh Esrei. And again, we said it's not a hefsek, it's not an interruption, it in fact is a form of prayer. And then, at the end, towards the very end of the davening, we blow some extra sounds. Why? To bring it to the nice round number of 100. Okay? Strictly speaking, you fulfilled the obligation without blowing 100 sounds. But by tradition, we round it out to 100. And how many sounds are blown at the very end of davening, after pretty much everything is all over, you blow some extra sounds to bring it up to 100. How many more you have to blow depends on whether you how many you blew till now. So those who blow in the silent Shemona Esrei as well as in the repetition only have to make up a few more. Those who blow only in the repetition will have to make up more. But whatever it is, we want to get it to the nice round number of 100. What's so special about 100? So here we have, at first glance, what seems to be a most peculiar reason. There is a story which is found in the book of Judges regarding a general by the name of Sisera, who was an enemy of the Jewish people, and who was a very powerful and successful general, and he waged war against the Jewish people. This is in the book of Judges, chapter 4. And it's at this time that the leader of the Jews was actually one of the great female leaders, Devorah, the prophetess. She was the judge in charge of the Jews at that time. And she got one of the Jewish generals, Barak ben Abinoam, to get an army together to go fight Sisera. And the books describe, the prophets describe, that Barak and his crew were successful in eliminating Sisera. And Sisera ran away, right? The battle was lost. He fled. And Barak, the Jewish general, chased him. Eventually, Sisera made his way to the tent of a woman by the name of Yael, whom he thought was an ally, but who instead, without the details now, put him to sleep and eventually killed him and told Barak, the Jewish general, Barak ben Abinoam, this is the guy you're looking for. So that's the story. And after this great military triumph, the prophetess Devorah sang a song of praise, a song of thanksgiving to God. And in the course of that song of thanksgiving, she describes the mother of Sisera sitting by the window waiting for her son to come home from battle. According to the Medrash, according to the rabbinic tradition, she wept 100 tears. And of course, her son never did come back. He was lost, you know, he was destroyed and defeated in battle. He was killed in battle. So she wept for her son, waiting for him to return with the spoils as he had done so many times before. And she wept 100 tears. And therefore, say the Balei HaTosfos, we blow 100 sounds with the shofar. What a disconnect. I mean, what does our practice on Rosh Hashanah have to do with this mother of this wicked enemy of the Jews, you know, who was a brutal general? I mean, you know, I guess we can, in a certain sense, feel a little bit of rachmanis, right, a little mercy for a mother waiting for her son to come home from battle. I mean, that does engender, even with an enemy, perhaps, a certain sense of mercy and a feeling of, you know, a poor woman, etc. But let's be honest for a moment. That's why we blow 100 sounds in the shofar. There's got to be something more than that. We're not worried about the mother of Sisera on Rosh Hashanah. She's the least of our problems today. Right? On Rosh Hashanah, what do we care? She cried 100 tears. So there are different suggestions. And it seems, as I say, at first glance, to be a terribly strange kind of illusion. But Rabbi Soloveitchik once explained that there are different words in Hebrew for crying, for weeping. And the word used over there with regard to the mother of Sisera is the word vatiabev or yevava, which is almost like a non-directed, non-cognitive response. It's a crying out, common to both human and animals, crying out in pain. But there's another word, and that's actually the word used with regards to Rachel that we mentioned earlier. It says, mini kolech mi bechi, bechia, crying. That's a crying which is based on intelligent understanding of a situation which one is in. It's a crying that includes a prayer. Sisera's mother had no one to cry to. It was just letting out tears of frustration and anguish, of pain. But Rachel, on the other hand, her crying reflected not only suffering, but hope and faith. And the truth, therefore, is that on Rosh Hashanah, when we blow the shofar, right, when we sound the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, so we commemorate the mother of Sisera, we recall that's how she cried. But that shouldn't be our limitation. Our shofar should not just be, we blow 100 sounds, that's the minimum, right? That's the crying of Sisera's mother. But we need to understand that the shofar, that our crying out to God has got to be much more than that. It's one approach. There's another interesting approach, and that is that the weeping of the mother of Sisera reflects, again, a lack of certainty and a lack of understanding of what's going to be in the future. her son came back victorious from many a battle. And certainly a loyal son brought his mother probably presents, spoils of war, okay, gold, silver, whatever, jewelry. And she had every reason to expect that this was going to happen again. But of course, this time it didn't happen. And therefore, we were reminded by the story of Sisera. We're not weeping for her, but we're alerting ourselves to the uncertainty of the future. This is Rosh Hashanah. We're blowing the shofar. Just because everything in my life has been a certain way till now, doesn't mean it's going to be like that tomorrow or the coming year. We all know that life can change in an instant. And sometimes all of our preconceived notions and everything which we were planning and everything we thought were going to be carried out in manner A, B, and C, and we plan, can turn around in a second. Your whole life can be turned upside down. There's an old Yiddish expression, a mensch tracht und Gott lacht, right? The person plans and God laughs. Because we make all these plans for the future and so on, and everything is based on certain premises, but sometimes the premise can change in a moment. That again goes back to the uncertainty of Rosh Hashanah. We blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah because there's a certain sense of what's going to be. And ultimately, I'll know that I have to trust in God. That's the tekiah, the long sound, all will be well. But the 100 sounds reminds us of the weeping of the mother of Sisera, not because we necessarily feel bad for her, again, except in the most general sense, Rachmanis, or a poor mother whose son has been killed in battle. But we're not worried about Sisera, who's a wicked person who tried to exterminate the Jewish people of his time. So we don't feel so bad for him. But we can reflect on that which his mother must have felt, that you know what, life changes in a moment. And everything which I thought, everything which I anticipated, everything which I planned, like that, it can be different. And so perhaps that's a reason why we sound 100 sounds in connection with the weeping of the mother of Sisera, not so much for what she wept about and why she wept, but the underlying comment, the underlying concept that life changes in a moment. Life does not always work out the way we plan for it. And therefore, ultimately, we have to have trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, I mentioned before that Tekiyah Shofar serves to remind us, among other things, of Matan Torah, of the temple, of the Messianic era, and again we'll talk about that, God willing, in the next year. But there's also another famous shofar that connects to Rosh Hashanah. And that, of course, is the shofar of Akedas Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak. Now, the word shofar isn't mentioned there in connection with the binding of Yitzchak, but the Torah tells us that when God asked Avram, God instructed Abraham to offer his son as a sacrifice on the altar, when God at the end rescinded and told him not to do it, Abraham found a ram whose horns had been caught in the thicket, in the brush, in the trees, and therefore couldn't get away, and Abraham sacrificed this ram instead. And that's the Elo Shel Yitzchak, the ram of Yitzchak, the ram's horn is the shofar. So shofar connects to this event as well. Now, on Rosh Hashanah, on the second day, we read about the story of Akedas Yitzchak. In the davening, we call upon God to remember the Akedas Yitzchak, the fact that Abraham was willing to bind his son Yitzchak to the altar and ultimately to kill him, had God ultimately demanded that. And we ask God to remember that for our benefit. And that's one of the things we read about. But the shofar recalls that as well. Now, why is it necessary to recall this event? So there are a number of major issues with the Akedah, which is somewhat perhaps even beyond what we can have time to go into now. But one of the things certainly is the sense of sacrifice. We hear the term sacrifice, and if we think about animals, so we think it's a pagan kind of culture almost, right? Who today thinks about taking an animal and slaughtering it and sprinkling blood? We have difficulty, modern man, at least in the Western world, has difficulty even relating to the concept. But without going to animal sacrifices right now, we can certainly relate to other kinds of sacrifice. There's personal sacrifice. Abraham was asked to sacrifice a lot, not just to kill his son. That wasn't the only challenge. That's a big enough challenge, right? What father would want to do that to his child? But you know, this was Abraham's only heir. It was the only person through whom his tradition would be continued. It means that if he's not going to have this son, then everything he worked for in his entire life would go down the drain. Like the recipe would die with him if there's nobody to carry it on. So these are tremendous things that Abraham had to undergo. I mean, sacrifice. We're called upon to sacrifice too. The shofar reminds us of sacrifice. What is it that we have to sacrifice? Sometimes we have to sacrifice comfort. It's not always easy to perform the mitzvahs and to serve God the way we're supposed to. Sometimes it's much more convenient to do other things. We have to sacrifice. We have to sacrifice money. a parent today who wishes to send his child to a yeshiva, to a Jewish day school, and so on and so forth, and high schools, it's a tremendous sacrifice, tremendous sum of money. I know people, you know, my wife has told me people that she works with, you know, when they hear what we pay to have our children educated in accordance with Jewish tradition, and the sacrifice that we make, it's an astounding thing. People can't believe it, right? But that's what we do. We also sacrifice on a personal level. Now, sometimes it's embarrassing to walk out in the street, perhaps dressed in a certain way, when it's much more comfortable to dress in a different way. These are sacrifices. Christ is something which all of us have to undergo to be Jews, to live as Jews. And that, the question is, what gives us the capacity to do that? Many Jews throughout history had to make the ultimate sacrifice. Our history is filled with examples of people who had to give up their lives, who had to see their children killed before their very eyes just because they're Jewish. And we don't mean to call unnecessary attention to that right now, but we pause and think about it. It's unbelievable. Jews have always been willing to sacrifice. So our sages tell us that's because it was implanted in us from Abraham. Shofar represents this willingness to sacrifice as well, to sacrifice and to give God what he demands of us. Our hope always is that things will be easy. Our hope is we'll be able to be comfortable, we'll be able to be full of joy and celebration when we perform every mitzvah. Realistically, though, it's not always like that. Indeed, to come back to the theme that we started with, often we fall asleep because, you know, we get tired of the routine, right? I do this every single day. How can I still be excited about it? I'm bored with it. I'm tired of it, right? People get tired of a particular routine. Comes the shofar and reminds us, no. There's a sacrifice. It's not always easy. You're right. Sometimes I have to get up to daven. And I said the same thing yesterday morning. So I can say to God, you know, I'll do the same thing yesterday, right? Same things yesterday. I'm going back to sleep. Can't do that. You have a mitzvah to perform. There's somebody who's in need of help. Sometimes we have to sacrifice financially for other people. That's part of our tradition. And not only sacrificing money, but sacrificing time. Sometimes someone else needs to hear a good word, needs to hear a word of encouragement, needs your help in moving something. We can think of countless examples where we're called upon to sacrifice. Hopefully, we'll never have to sacrifice the ultimate sacrifice, sacrifice lives and sacrifice children, God forbid, as our ancestors did, as is well documented throughout Jewish history. But we do have to make sacrifices. Rosh Hashanah calls us to remember that as well. However, the ultimate reward for Abraham, when Avram was willing to sacrifice his son, and by the way, let's not lose sight of Yitzhak here. Okay, and we always refer to Abraham as being the great hero of the story, but Isaac was a pretty big hero too. According to the calculation of many commentaries, he was 37 years old. Sometimes we have a picture of the Akedah, of the father leading the little boy, and the boy doesn't really know what's going on, and you know the father's doing this, and he's asking daddy why this, and daddy why that, and the father says don't worry, and the kid doesn't understand what's going on. But that's not really accurate. According to Rashi and other commentaries, Isaac was 37. And Isaac could well have said, sacrifice? Not me, thanks. Okay, you want to undergo your test, that's your business, but leave me out of it. But he didn't do that. So he's a great hero of the Akedah too, and there's a lot to say about that. But the point of the matter is, the ultimate reward for Avraham, again, at the end, as the verse says, and we quote it, and we read it on Rosh Hashanah as part of the davening, is that the part of the Torah reading is that God says, now you're going to get the ultimate reward. That's our belief. When we sacrifice, the reward is blessing. Just conclude with a very fascinating thing that comes at the very end of that section that we read on Rosh Hashanah with the Akedah. And again, it's a little off the shofar subject, but in some sense, perhaps it relates very, very much to the shofar subject. The Torah reading ends with a description of a message that Abraham received from his brother, whose wife and his concubine had altogether 12 children. And it lists their names. That's the end of the Torah reading. Now, isn't that anticlimactic? I mean, you just spoke about the glory and the majesty of Akedas Yitzhak and Abraham's willingness to sacrifice his son and Isaac's willingness to participate and God promising now you're going to get the blessing and so on. And by the way, you know, your brother had 8 kids and so on. I mean, who were these people? Not great, righteous people. It just so happens that Rebecca, stemmed from them. But she, you know, and she's mentioned here. But still, it seems terribly anticlimactic. Perhaps, as some suggest, it draws a contrast. Here was Abraham with his one and only son, willing to give up his life. And the brother had 12 children. Right? Every child is precious, but still, it sort of draws this contrast. But the Rav Soloveitchik suggested something else, and this is pivotal, I think, as well, to the mitzvah of shofar. The fact of the matter is, after a dramatic event such as the Akedah, the sacrifice and so on, and here he had a sacrifice for his one child, and his brother Nachor almost effortlessly had all kinds of children. It sort of symbolizes, if you will, going back to the normal way of the world. The Torah includes this thing because now it goes back to Abraham's personal life. You just reach this tremendous spiritual level, that's not where it ends. Now you've got to go back to normal day-to-day living. The Akedah is a majestic one-time experience, but it's only meaningful if now it's going to impact as you go back into the world. So right after Abraham hears about this, right after Abraham is willing to sacrifice his son, he hears about this, he's got a message. Brother had a child, this, back to regular life. Sometimes it's very hard. We come to Shul on Rosh Hashanah, and we hear the shofar, and we're moved by it, and we carry out some of the, we have in mind some of the themes that we've discussed here. But when is that meaningful? Hey, tomorrow there's not going to be any shofar blowing. Once Rosh Hashanah is over, there's no more shofar. We go back to day life, back to work, and back to school, and back to our needs, and back to our problems, and back to everything else. Life is not about the momentary, majestic, dramatic activities. Those, perhaps, if we carry them out properly, serve as we might call in the medical world booster shots. Right? You get a shot. So at that moment, this is, you get an infusion of emotion, or an infusion of passion, or an infusion of understanding of God, or everything that shofar symbolizes. But the challenge is to maintain it, because you're going to have to go back right after this is over. You know, right? I mean, you know, even on Rosh Hashanah itself. Tekiah shofar is over, we got to go home and set the table and clear the dishes. What do you mean? I just pulled a shofar. How can I get involved in such mundane things as helping my wife set the table, right? Or clearing off after lunch. But no, that's the human condition. So yes, there are majestic events, there are majestic moments, there's shofar and all it symbolizes. But it's worthwhile only if you're able to use that as a springboard and you go back into the regular world, so to speak, go back to your regular routine. It's not the special moments that that make or break or define what a person is. It's the moments that follow. And so when we hear the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, as I said at the outset, it's a time of looking forward. It's a time of potential. It's a time of proceeding, of being clear where I'm proceeding to and what I'm proceeding to do. You carry the shofar with you. It's not just something that you hear at that moment and are moved at that moment and then leave alone behind you. That's what Avraham Avinu understood. Yes, he reached his great lofty spiritual height with the Akedah, willing to sacrifice his own son. But right after that, back to business, back to normal. Can he maintain his lofty level afterwards? That's the real challenge. And so we celebrate Rosh Hashanah and we come to spiritual heights, God willing. And the idea is to take those heights and build from them and use that to influence and to impact our behavior as we go through our regular routines as well.